Apollinar Mascotte did not lose his calm. He introduced them to two of his daughters, who happened to be there. Amparo, 16, dark like her mother, and Remedios, only 9, a pretty little girl with lily-coloured skin and green eyes. They were gracious and well-mannered. As soon as the men came in, before being introduced, they gave them chairs to sit on, but they both remained standing. "Very well, my friend," José Arcadio Buendía said, "you may stay here, not because you have those bandits with shotguns at the door, but out of consideration for your wife and daughters." Don Apolinar Mascotte was upset, but José Arcadio Buendía did not give him time to reply. "We only make 2 conditions," he went on. "The first, that everyone can paint his house the color he feels like. The second, that the soldiers leave at once. We will guarantee order for you." The magistrate raised his right hand with all the fingers extended. "Your word of honor?" "The word of your enemy," José Arcadio Buendía said, and he added in a bitter tone, "because I must tell you one thing. You and I are still enemies." The soldiers left that same afternoon. A few days later, José Arcadio Buendía found a house for the magistrate's family. Everybody was at peace, except Aureliano. The image of Remedios, the magistrate's younger daughter, who, because of her age, could have been his daughter, kept paining him in some part of his body. It was a physical sensation that almost bothered him when he walked, like a pebble in his shoe. The new house, white like a dove, was inaugurated with a dance. Ursula had got that idea from the afternoon when she saw Rebecca and Amaranta changed into adolescence, and it could almost have been said that the main reason behind the construction was a desire to have a proper place for the girls to receive visitors. In order that nothing would be lacking in splendour, she worked like a galley slave as the repairs were underway, so that before they were finished, she had ordered costly necessities for the decorations, the table service, and the marvellous invention that was to arouse the astonishment of the town and the jubilation of the young people, the pianola. They delivered it broken down, packed in several boxes that were unloaded along with the Viennese furniture, the Bohemian crystal, the table service from the Indies Company, the tablecloths from Holland, and a rich variety of lamps and candlesticks, hangings and drapes. The import house sent along at its own expense an Italian expert, Pietro Crespi, to assemble and tune the pianola, to instruct the purchasers in its functioning, and to teach them how to dance the latest music printed on its 6 paper rolls. Pietro Crespi was young and blonde, the most handsome and well-mannered man who had ever been seen in Macondo, so scrupulous in his dress that in spite of the suffocating heat, he would work in his brocade vest and heavy coat of dark cloth. Soaked in sweat, keeping a reverent distance from the owners of the house, he spent several weeks shut up in the parlour with a dedication much like that of Aureliano in his silverwork. One morning, without opening the door, without calling anyone to witness the miracle, he placed the first roll in the pianola, and the tormenting hammering and the constant noise of wooden laughings ceased in a silence that was startled at the order and neatness of the music. They all ran to the parlour. José Arcadio Buendía was as if struck by lightning, not because of the beauty of the melody, but because of the automatic working of the keys of the pianola, and he set up Melquiades' camera with the hope of getting a daguerreotype of the invisible player. That day the Italian had lunch with them. Rebecca and Amaranta, serving the table, were intimidated by the way in which the angelic man with pale and ringless hands manipulated the utensils. In the living room, next to the parlour, Pietro Crespi taught them how to dance. He showed them the steps without touching them, keeping time with a metronome, under the friendly eye of Ursula, who did not leave the room for a moment while her daughters had their lesson. Pietro Crespi wore special pants on those days, very elastic and tight, and dancing slippers. "You don't have to worry so much," José Arcadio Buendía told her. "The man's a fairy." But she did not leave off her vigilance until the apprenticeship was over, and the Italian left Macondo. Then they began to organize the party. Ursula drew up a strict guest list, in which the only ones invited were the descendants of the founders, except for the family of Pilar Ternera, who by then had had two more children by unknown fathers. It was truly a high-class list, except that it was determined by feelings of friendship, for those favoured were not only the oldest friends of José Arcadio Buendía's house, since before they undertook the exodus and the founding of Macondo, but also their sons and grandsons, who were the constant companions of Aureliano and Arcadio since infancy, and their daughters, who were the only ones who visited the house to embroider with Rebecca and Amaranta. Don Apolinar Moscote, the benevolent ruler whose activity had been reduced to the maintenance from his scanty resources of two policemen armed with wooden clubs, was a figurehead. In order to support the household expenses, his daughters had opened a sewing shop, where they made felt flowers as well as guava delicacies, and wrote love notes to order. But in spite of being modest and hard-working, the most beautiful girls in town, and the most skilled at the new dances, they did not manage to be considered for the party. While Ursula and the girls unpacked furniture, polished silverware, and hung pictures of maidens in boats full of roses, which gave a breath of new life to the naked areas that the masons had built, José Arcadio Buendía stopped his pursuit of the image of God, convinced of his non-existence, and he took the pianola apart in order to decipher its magical secret. 2 days before the party, swamped in a shower of leftover keys and hammers, bungling in the midst of a mix-up of strings that would unroll in one direction and roll up again in the other, he succeeded in a fashion in putting the instrument back together. There had never been as many surprises and as much dashing about as in those days, but the new pitch lamps were lighted on the designated day and hour. The house was opened, still smelling of resin and damp whitewash, and the children and grandchildren of the founders saw the porch with ferns and begonias, the quiet rooms, the garden saturated with the fragrance of the roses, and they gathered together in the parlour, facing the unknown invention that had been covered with a white sheet. Those who were familiar with the piano, popular in other towns in the swamp, felt a little disheartened, but more bitter was Ursula's disappointment when she put in the first roll, so that Amaranta and Rebecca could begin the dancing, and the mechanism did not work. Melquiades, almost blind by then, crumbling with decrepitude, used the arts of his timeless wisdom in an attempt to fix it. Finally, José Arcadio Buendía managed, by mistake, to move a device that was stuck, and the music came out, first in a burst and then in a flow of mixed-up notes. Beating against the strings that had been put in without order or concert and had been tuned with temerity, the hammers let go. But the stubborn descendants of the 21 intrepid people who ploughed through the mountains in search of the sea to the west avoided the reefs of the melodic mix-up, and the dancing went on until dawn. Pietro Crespi came back to repair the pianola. Rebecca and Amaranta helped him put the strings in order, and helped him with their laughter at the mix-up of the melodies. It was extremely pleasant, and so chaste in its way, that Ursula ceased her vigilance. On the eve of his departure, a farewell dance for him was improvised with the pianola, and with Rebecca he put on a skillful demonstration of modern dances. Arcadio and Amaranta matched them in grace and skill. But the exhibition was interrupted because Pilar Ternera, who was at the door with the onlookers, had a fight, biting and hair-pulling, with a woman who had dared to comment that Arcadio had a woman's behind. Toward midnight, Pietro Crespi took his leave with a sentimental little speech, and he promised to return very soon. Rebecca accompanied him to the door, and having closed up the house and put out the lamps, she went to her room to weep. It was an inconsolable weeping that lasted for several days, the cause of which was not known even by Amaranta. Her hermetism was not odd. Although she seemed expansive and cordial, she had a solitary character and an impenetrable heart. She was a splendid adolescent with long and firm bones, but she still insisted on using the small wooden rocking chair with which she had arrived at the house, reinforced many times, and with the arms gone. No one had discovered that even at that age she still had the habit of sucking her finger. That was why she would not lose an opportunity to lock herself in the bathroom, and had acquired the habit of sleeping with her face to the wall. On rainy afternoons, embroidering with a group of friends on the begonia porch, she would lose the thread of the conversation, and a tear of nostalgia would salt her palate when she saw the strips of damp earth and the piles of mud that the earthworms had pushed up in the garden. Those secret tastes, defeated in the past by oranges and rhubarb, broke out into an irrepressible urge when she began to weep. She went back to eating earth. The first time she did it, almost out of curiosity, sure that the bad taste would be the best cure for the temptation, and, in fact, she could not bear the earth in her mouth. But she persevered, overcome by the growing anxiety, and little by little she was getting back her ancestral appetite, the taste of primary minerals, the unbridled satisfaction of what was the original food. She would put handfuls of earth in her pockets, and ate them in small bits without being seen, with a confused feeling of pleasure and rage, as she instructed her girlfriends in the most difficult needlepoint, and spoke about other men who did not deserve the sacrifice of having one eat the whitewash on the walls because of them. The handfuls of earth made the only man who deserved that show of degradation less remote and more certain, as if the ground that he walked on with his fine patent leather boots in another part of the world were transmitting to her the weight and the temperature of his blood in a mineral savour that left a harsh aftertaste in her mouth and a sediment of peace in her heart. One afternoon, for no reason, Amparo Moscote asked permission to see the house. Amaranta and Rebecca, disconcerted by the unexpected visit, attended her with a stiff formality. They showed her the remodeled mansion, they had her listen to the rolls on the pianola, and they offered her orange marmalade and crackers. Amparo gave a lesson in dignity, personal charm, and good manners that impressed Ursula in the few moments that she was present during the visit. After 2 hours, when the conversation was beginning to wane, Amparo took advantage of Amaranta's distraction and gave Rebecca a letter. She was able to see the name of the estimable Señorita Rebecca Buendía, written in the same methodical hand, with the same green ink, and the same delicacy of words with which the instructions for the operation of the pianola were written, and she folded the letter with the tips of her fingers and hid it in her bosom, looking at Amparo Moscote with an expression of endless and unconditional gratitude, and a silent promise of complicity unto death. The sudden friendship between Amparo Moscote and Rebecca Buendía awakened the hopes of Aureliano. The memory of little Remedios had not stopped tormenting him, but he had not found a chance to see her. When he would stroll through town with his closest friends, Magnifico Bispal and Gerineldo Márquez, the sons of the founders of the same names, he would look for her in the sewing shop with an anxious glance, but he saw only the older sisters. The presence of Amparo Moscote in the house was like a premonition. "She has to come with her," Aureliano would say to himself in a low voice. "She has to come." He repeated it so many times, and with such conviction, that one afternoon when he was putting together a little gold fish in the workshop, he had the certainty that she had answered his call. Indeed, a short time later he heard the childish voice, and when he looked up, his heart froze with terror as he saw the girl at the door, dressed in pink organdy and wearing white boots. "You can't go in there, Remedios," Amparo Moscote said from the hall. "They're working." But Aureliano did not give her time to respond. He picked up the little fish by the chain that came through its mouth and said to her, "Come in." Remedios went over and asked some questions about the fish that Aureliano could not answer because he was seized with a sudden attack of asthma. He wanted to stay beside that lily skin forever, beside those emerald eyes, close to that voice that called him "Sir," with every question, showing the same respect that she gave her father. Melquiades was in the corner, seated at the desk, scribbling indecipherable signs. Aureliano hated him. All he could do was tell Remedios that he was going to give her the little fish, and the girl was so startled by the offer that she left the workshop as fast as she could. That afternoon Aureliano lost the hidden patience with which he had waited for a chance to see her. He neglected his work. In several desperate efforts of concentration, he willed her to appear, but Remedios did not respond. He looked for her in her sister's shop, behind the window shades in her house, in her father's office, but he found her only in the image that saturated his private and terrible solitude. He would spend whole hours with Rebecca in the parlour, listening to the music on the pianola. She was listening to it because it was the music with which Pietro Crespi had taught them how to dance. Aureliano listened to it simply because everything, even music, reminded him of Remedios. The house became full of love. Aureliano expressed it in poetry that had no beginning or end. He would write it on the harsh pieces of parchment that Melquiades gave him, on the bathroom walls, on the skin of his arms, and in all of it Remedios would appear transfigured. Remedios in the soporific air of 2 in the afternoon, Remedios in the soft breath of the roses, Remedios in the water-clock secrets of the moths, Remedios in the steaming morning bread, Remedios everywhere and Remedios forever. Rebecca waited for her love at 4 in the afternoon, embroidering by the window. She knew that the mailman's mule arrived only every 2 weeks, but she always waited for him, convinced that he was going to arrive on some other day by mistake. It happened quite the opposite. Once the mule did not come on the usual day. Mad with desperation, Rebecca got up in the middle of the night and ate handfuls of earth in the garden with a suicidal drive, weeping with pain and fury, chewing tender earthworms and chipping her teeth on snail shells. She vomited until dawn. She fell into a state of feverish prostration, lost consciousness, and her heart went into a shameless delirium. Ursula, scandalized, forced the lock on her trunk and found at the bottom, tied together with pink ribbons, the 16 perfumed letters and the skeletons of leaves and petals preserved in old books and the dried butterflies that turned to powder at the touch. Aureliano was the only one capable of understanding such desolation. That afternoon, while Ursula was trying to rescue Rebecca from the slough of delirium, he went with Magnifico Bisbal and Gerineldo Marquez to Caterino's store. The establishment had been expanded with a gallery of wooden rooms, where single women who smelled of dead flowers lived. A group made up of an accordion and drums played the songs of Francisco the Man, who had not been seen in Macondo for several years. The three friends drank fermented cane juice. Magnifico and Gerineldo, contemporaries of Aureliano, but more skilled in the ways of the world, drank methodically with the women seated on their laps. One of the women, withered and with gold work on her teeth, gave Aureliano a caress that made him shudder. He rejected her. He had discovered that the more he drank, the more he thought about Remedios. But he could bear the torture of his recollections better. He did not know exactly when he began to float. He saw his friends and the women sailing in a radiant glow, without weight or mass, saying words that did not come out of their mouths, and making mysterious signals that did not correspond to their expressions. Caterino put a hand on his shoulder and said to him, "It's going on 11." Aureliano turned his head, saw the enormous disfigured face with a felt flower behind the ear, and then he lost his memory, as during the times of forgetfulness, and he recovered it on a strange dawn and in a room that was completely foreign, where Pilar Ternera stood in her slip, barefoot, her hair down, holding a lamp over him, startled with disbelief. "Aureliano!" Aureliano checked his feet and raised his head. He did not know how he had come there, but he knew what his aim was, because he had carried it hidden since infancy in an inviolable backwater of his heart. "I've come to sleep with you," he said. His clothes were smeared with mud and vomit. Pilar Ternera, who lived alone at that time with her 2 younger children, did not ask him any questions. She took him to the bed. She cleaned his face with a damp cloth, took off his clothes, and then got completely undressed and lowered the mosquito netting so that her children would not see them if they woke up. She had become tired of waiting for the man who would stay, of the men who left, of the countless men who missed the road to her house, confused by the uncertainty of the cards. During the wait, her skin had become wrinkled, her breasts had withered, the coals of her heart had gone out. She felt for Aureliano in the darkness, put her hand on his stomach and kissed him on the neck with a maternal tenderness. "My poor child," she murmured. Aureliano shuddered. With a calm skill, without the slightest misstep, he left his accumulated grief behind and found Remedios changed into a swamp without horizons, smelling of a raw animal and recently ironed clothes. When he came to the surface he was weeping. First they were involuntary and broken sobs. Then he emptied himself out in an unleashed flow, feeling that something swollen and painful had burst inside of him. She waited, scratching his head with the tips of her fingers, until his body got rid of the dark material that would not let him live. Then Pilar Ternera asked him, "Who is it?" And Aureliano told her. She let out a laugh that in other times frightened the doves, and that now did not even wake up the children. "You'll have to raise her first," she mocked, but underneath the mockery Aureliano found a reservoir of understanding. When he went out of the room, leaving behind not only his doubts about his virility, but also the bitter weight that his heart had borne for so many months, Pilar Ternera made him a spontaneous promise. "I'm going to talk to the girl," she told him, "and you'll see what I'll serve her on the tray." She kept her promise. But it was a bad moment, because the house had lost its peace of former days. When she discovered Rebecca's passion, which was impossible to keep secret because of her shouts, Amaranta suffered an attack of fever. She also suffered from the barb of a lonely love. Shut up in the bathroom, she would release herself from the torment of a hopeless passion by writing feverish letters, which she finally hid in the bottom of her trunk. Ursula barely had the strength to take care of the two sick girls. She was unable, after prolonged and insidious interrogations, to ascertain the causes of Amaranta's prostration. Finally, in another moment of inspiration, she forced the lock on the trunk and found the letters tied with a pink ribbon, swollen with fresh lilies and still wet with tears, addressed and never sent to Pietro Crespi. Weeping with rage, she cursed the day that it had occurred to her to buy the pianola, and she forbade the embroidery lessons and decreed a kind of mourning with no one dead, which was to be prolonged until the daughters got over their hopes. Useless was the intervention of José Arcadio Buendía, who had modified his first impression of Pietro Crespi and admired his ability in the manipulation of musical machines. So that when Pilar Ternera told Aureliano that Remedios had decided on marriage, he could see that the news would only give his parents more trouble. Invited to the parlor for a formal interview, José Arcadio Buendía and Ursula listened stonily to their son's declaration. When he learned the name of the fiancée, however, José Arcadio Buendía grew red with indignation. "Love is a disease," he thundered, "with so many pretty and decent girls around. The only thing that occurs to you is to get married to the daughter of our enemy." But Ursula agreed with the choice. She confessed her affection for the seven Moscote sisters, for their beauty, their ability for work, their modesty, and their good manners, and she celebrated her son's prudence. Conquered by his wife's enthusiasm, José Arcadio Buendía then laid down one condition. Rebecca, who was the one he wanted, would marry Pietro Crespi. Ursula would take Amaranta on a trip to the capital of the province when she had time, so that contact with different people would alleviate her disappointment. Rebecca got her health back just as soon as she heard of the agreement, and she wrote her fiancé a jubilant letter that she submitted to her parents' approval and put into the mail without the use of any intermediaries. Amaranta pretended to accept the decision, and little by little she recovered from her fevers. But she promised herself that Rebecca would marry only over her dead body. The following Saturday, José Arcadio Buendía put on his dark suit, his celluloid collar, and the deerskin boots that he had worn for the first time the night of the party, and went to ask for the hand of Remedios Moscote. The magistrate and his wife received him, pleased and worried at the same time, for they did not know the reason for the unexpected visit. And then they thought that he was confused about the name of the intended bride. In order to remove the mistake, the mother woke Remedios up and carried her into the living room, still drowsy from sleep. They asked her if it was true that she had decided to get married, and she answered, whimpering, that she only wanted them to let her sleep. José Arcadio Buendía, understanding the distress of the Moscotes, went to clear things up with Aureliano. When he returned, The Muscotes had put on formal clothing, had rearranged the furniture and put fresh flowers in the vases, and were waiting in the company of their older daughters. Overwhelmed by the unpleasantness of the occasion and the bothersome hard collar, José Arcadio Buendía confirmed the fact that Remedios, indeed, was the chosen one. "It doesn't make sense," Don Apolinar Moscote said with consternation. "We have 6 other daughters, all unmarried, and at an age where they deserve it, who would be delighted to be the honorable wife of a gentleman as serious and hard-working as your son. And Aurelito lays his eyes precisely on the one who still wets her bed." His wife, a well-preserved woman with afflicted eyelids and expression, scolded his mistake. When they finished the fruit punch, they willingly accepted Aureliano's decision, except that Señora Moscote begged the favor of speaking to Ursula alone. Intrigued, protesting that they were involving her in men's affairs, but really feeling deep emotion, Ursula went to visit her the next day. A half hour later, she returned with the news that Remedios had not reached puberty. Aureliano did not consider that a serious barrier. He had waited so long that he could wait as long as was necessary until his bride reached the age of conception. The newfound harmony was interrupted by the death of Melquiades. Although it was a foreseeable event, the circumstances were not. A few months after his return, a process of aging had taken place in him that was so rapid and critical that soon he was treated as one of those useless great-grandfathers who wander about the bedrooms like shades, dragging their feet, remembering better times aloud, and whom no one bothers about or remembers, really, until the morning they find them dead in their bed. At first, José Arcadio Buendía helped him in his work, enthusiastic over the novelty of the daguerreotypes and the predictions of Nostradamus. But little by little he began abandoning him to his solitude, for communication was becoming increasingly difficult. He was losing his sight and his hearing. He seemed to confuse the people he was speaking to with others he had known in remote epochs of mankind, and he would answer questions with a complex hodgepodge of languages. He would walk along, groping in the air, although he passed between objects with an inexplicable fluidity, as if he were endowed with some instinct of direction based on an immediate prescience. One day he forgot to put in his false teeth, which at night he left in a glass of water beside his bed, and he never put them in again. When Ursula undertook the enlargement of the house, she had them build him a special room next to Aureliano's workshop, far from the noise and bustle of the house, with a window flooded with light, and a bookcase where she herself put in order the books that were almost destroyed by dust and moths, the flaky stacks of paper covered with indecipherable signs, and the glass with his false teeth, where some aquatic plants with tiny yellow flowers had taken root. The new place seemed to please Melquiades, because he was never seen any more, not even in the dining room. He only went to Aureliano's workshop, where he would spend hours on end scribbling his enigmatic literature on the parchments that he had brought with him, and that seemed to have been made out of some dry material that crumpled like puff paste. There he ate the meals that Visitacion brought him twice a day, although in the last days he lost his appetite, and fed only on vegetables. He soon acquired the forlorn look that one sees in vegetarians. His skin became covered with a thin moss, similar to that which flourished on the antique vest that he never took off, and his breath exhaled the odor of a sleeping animal. Aureliano ended up forgetting about him, absorbed in the composition of his poems. But on one occasion he thought he understood something of what Melquiades was saying in his groping monologues, and he paid attention. In reality, the only thing that could be isolated in the rocky paragraphs was the insistent hammering on the word equinox, 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 and the name of Alexander von Humboldt. Arcadio got a little closer to him when he began to help Aureliano in his silver work. Melquiades answered that effort at communication at times by giving forth with phrases in Spanish that had very little to do with reality. One afternoon, however, he seemed to be illuminated by a sudden emotion. Years later, facing the firing squad, Arcadio would remember the trembling with which Melquiades made him listen to several pages of his impenetrable writing, which, of course, he did not understand, but which, when read aloud, were like encyclicals being chanted. Then he smiled for the first time in a long while, and said in Spanish, "When I die, burn mercury in my room for 3 days." Arcadio told that to José Arcadio Buendía, and the latter tried to get more explicit information, but he received only one answer. "I have found immortality." When Melquiades' breathing began to smell, Arcadio took him to bathe in the river on Thursday mornings. He seemed to get better. He would undress and get into the water with the boys, and his mysterious sense of orientation would allow him to avoid the deep and dangerous spots. "We come from the water," he said on a certain occasion. Much time passed in that way without anyone seeing him in the house, except on the night when he made a pathetic effort to fix the pianola, and when he would go to the river with Arcadio, carrying under his arm a gourd and a bar of palm oil soap wrapped in a towel. One Thursday, before they called him to go to the river, Aureliano heard him say, "I have died of fever on the dunes of Singapore." That day he went into the water at a bad spot, and they did not find him until the following day, a few miles downstream, washed up on a bright bend in the river, and with a solitary vulture sitting on his stomach. Over the scandalized protests of Ursula, who wept with more grief than she had had for her own father, José Arcadio Buendía was opposed to their burying him. "He is immortal," he said, and he himself revealed the formula of his resurrection. He brought out the forgotten water pipe, and put a kettle of mercury to boil next to the body, which little by little was filling with blue bubbles. Don Apolinar Moscote ventured to remind him that an unburied drowned man was a danger to public health. "None of that, because he's alive," was the answer of José Arcadio Buendía, who finished the 72 hours with the mercurial incense, as the body was already beginning to burst with a livid fluorescence, the soft whistles of which impregnated the house with a pestilential vapour. Only then did he permit them to bury him, not in any ordinary way, but with the honours reserved for Macondo's greatest benefactor. It was the first burial, and the best-attended one that was ever seen in the town, only surpassed, a century later, by Big Mama's funeral carnival. They buried him in a grave dug in the centre of the plot destined for the cemetery, with a stone on which they wrote the only thing they knew about him, Melquiades. They gave him his 9 nights of wake. In the tumult that gathered in the courtyard to drink coffee, tell jokes, and play cards, Amaranta found a chance to confess her love to Pietro Crespi, who a few weeks before had formalized his promise to Rebecca and had set up a store for musical instruments and mechanical toys in the same section where the Arabs had lingered in other times, swapping knick-knacks for macaws, and which the people called the Street of the Turks. The Italian, whose head, covered with patent leather curls, aroused in women an irrepressible need to sigh, dealt with Amaranta as with a capricious little girl who was not worth taking seriously. "I have a younger brother," he told her. "He's coming to help me in the store." Amaranta felt humiliated and told Pietro Crespi with a virulent anger that she was prepared to stop her sister's wedding, even if her own dead body had to lie across the door. The Italian was so impressed by the dramatics of the threat that he could not resist the temptation to mention it to Rebecca. That was how Amaranta's trip, always put off by Ursula's work, was arranged in less than a week. Amaranta put up no resistance, but when she kissed Rebecca goodbye, she whispered in her ear, "Don't get your hopes up. Even if they send me to the ends of the earth, I'll find some way of stopping you from getting married, even if I have to kill you." With the absence of Ursula, with the invisible presence of Melquiades, who continued his stealthy shuffling through the rooms, the house seemed enormous and empty. Rebecca took charge of domestic order, while the Indian woman took care of the bakery. At dusk, when Pietro Crespi would arrive, preceded by a cool breath of lavender and always bringing a toy as a gift, his fiancée would receive the visitor in the main parlour with doors and windows open to be safe from any suspicion. It was an unnecessary precaution, for the Italian had shown himself to be so respectful that he did not even touch the hand of the woman who was going to be his wife within the year. Those visits were filling the house with remarkable toys. mechanical ballerinas, music boxes, acrobatic monkeys, trotting horses, clowns who played the tambourine. The rich and startling mechanical fauna that Pietro Crespi brought dissipated José Arcadio Buendía's afflictions over the death of Melquiades and carried him back to his old days as an alchemist. He lived, at that time, in a paradise of disemboweled animals, of mechanisms that had been taken apart in an attempt to perfect them with a system of perpetual motion based upon the principles of the pendulum. Aureliano, for his part, had neglected the workshop in order to teach little Remedios to read and write. At first, the child preferred her dolls to the man who would come every afternoon, and who was responsible for her being separated from her toys in order to be bathed and dressed and seated in the parlour to receive the visitor. But Aureliano's patience and devotion finally won her over, up to the point where she would spend many hours with him, studying the meaning of the letters and sketching in a notebook with coloured pencils, little houses with cows in the corral, and round suns with yellow rays that hid behind the hills. Only Rebecca was unhappy, because of Amaranta's threat. She knew her sister's character, the haughtiness of her spirit, and she was frightened by the virulence of her anger. She would spend whole hours sucking her finger in the bathroom, holding herself back with an exhausting iron will so as not to eat earth. In search of some relief for her uncertainty, she called Pilar Ternera to read her future. After a string of conventional vagaries, Pilar Ternera predicted, "You will not be happy as long as your parents remain unburied." Rebecca shuddered, as in the memory of a dream she saw herself entering the house as a very small girl, with the trunk and the little rocker, and a bag whose contents she had never known. She remembered a bald gentleman dressed in linen, and with his collar closed by a gold button, who had nothing to do with the King of Hearts. She remembered a very young and beautiful woman with warm and perfumed hands, who had nothing in common with the Jack of Diamonds and his rheumatic hands, and who used to put flowers in her hair and take her out walking in the afternoon through a town with green streets. "I don't understand," she said. Pilar Ternera seemed disconcerted. "I don't either, but that's what the cards say." Rebecca was so preoccupied with the enigma that she told it to José Arcadio Buendía, and he scolded her for believing in the predictions of the cards. But he undertook the silent task of searching closets and trunks, moving furniture and turning over beds and floorboards, looking for the bag of bones. He remembered that he had not seen it since the time of the rebuilding. He secretly summoned the masons, and one of them revealed that he had walled up the bag in some bedroom, because it bothered him in his work. After several days of listening, with their ears against the walls, they perceived the deep clock, clock. They penetrated the wall, and there were the bones in the intact bag. They buried it the same day in a grave without a stone, next to that of Melquiades, and José Arcadio Buendía returned home free of a burden that for a moment had weighed on his conscience as much as the memory of Prudencio Aguilar. When he went through the kitchen, he kissed Rebecca on the forehead. "Get those bad thoughts out of your head," he told her. "You're going to be happy." The friendship with Rebecca opened up to Pilar Ternera the doors of the house, closed by Ursula since the birth of Arcadio. She would arrive at any hour of the day, like a flock of goats, and would unleash her feverish energy in the hardest tasks. Sometimes she would go into the workshop and help Arcadio sensitize the daguerreotype plates with an efficiency and a tenderness that ended up by confusing him. That woman bothered him. The tan of her skin, her smell of smoke, the disorder of her laughter in the dark room distracted his attention and made him bump into things. On a certain occasion, Aureliano was there working on his silver, and Pilar Ternera leaned over the table to admire his laborious patience. Suddenly it happened. Aureliano made sure that Arcadio was in the dark room before raising his eyes and meeting those of Pilar Ternera, whose thought was perfectly visible, as if exposed to the light of noon. "Well," Aureliano said, "tell me what it is." Pilar Ternera bit her lips with a sad smile. "That you'd be good in a war," she said. "Where you put your eye,
you put your bullet.
Aureliano relaxed with the proof of the omen. He went back to concentrate on his work as if nothing had happened, and his voice took on a restful strength. I will recognize him, he said. He'll bear my name. José Arcadio Buendía finally got what he was looking for. He connected the mechanism of the clock to a mechanical ballerina, and the toy danced uninterruptedly to the rhythm of her own music for 3 days. That discovery excited him much more than any of his other harebrained undertakings. He stopped eating. He stopped sleeping. Only the vigilance and care of Rebecca kept him from being dragged off by his imagination into a state of perpetual delirium from which he would not recover. He would spend the nights walking around the room thinking aloud, searching for a way to apply the principles of the pendulum to ox carts, to harrows, to everything that was useful when put into motion. The fever of insomnia fatigued him so much that one dawn he could not recognize the old man with white hair and uncertain gestures who came into his bedroom. It was Prudencio Aguilar. When he finally identified him, startled that the dead also aged, José Arcadio Buendía felt himself shaken by nostalgia. Prudencio, he exclaimed, you've come from a long way off. After many years of death, the yearning for the living was so intense, the need for company so pressing, so terrifying the nearness of that other death which exists within death, that Prudencio Aguilar had ended up loving his worst enemy. He had spent a great deal of time looking for him. He asked the dead from Riohacha about him, the dead who came from the Upar Valley, those who came from the swamp, and no one could tell him because Macondo was a town that was unknown to the dead until Melquiades arrived and marked it with a small black dot on the motley maps of death. José Arcadio Buendía conversed with Prudencio Aguilar until dawn. A few hours later, worn out by the vigil, he went into Aureliano's workshop and asked him, "What day is today?" Aureliano told him that it was Tuesday. "I was thinking the same thing," José Arcadio Buendía said, "but suddenly I realized that it's still Monday, like yesterday. Look at the sky, look at the walls, look at the begonias. Today is Monday, too." Used to his manias, Aureliano paid no attention to him. On the next day, Wednesday, José Arcadio Buendía went back to the workshop. "This is a disaster," he said. "Look at the air. Listen to the buzzing of the sun, the same as yesterday and the day before. Today is Monday, too." That night, Pietro Crespi found him on the porch, weeping for Prudencio Aguilar, for Melquiades, for Rebecca's parents, for his mother and father, for all of those he could remember and who were now alone in death. He gave him a mechanical bear that walked on its hind legs on a tightrope, but he could not distract him from his obsession. He asked him what had happened to the project he had explained to him a few days before, about the possibility of building a pendulum machine that would help men to fly, and he answered that it was impossible, because a pendulum could lift anything into the air, but it could not lift itself. On Thursday he appeared in the workshop again with the painful look of ploughed ground. "The time machine has broken," he almost sobbed, "and Ursula and Amaranth are so far away." Aureliano scolded him like a child, and he adopted a contrite air. He spent 6 hours examining things, trying to find a difference from their appearance on the previous day, in the hope of discovering in them some change that would reveal the passage of time. He spent the whole night in bed with his eyes open, calling to Prudencio Aguilar, to Melquiades, to all the dead, so that they would share his distress. But no one came. On Friday, before anyone arose, he watched the appearance of nature again until he did not have the slightest doubt but that it was Monday. Then he grabbed the bar from a door, and with the savage violence of his uncommon strength, he smashed to dust the equipment in the alchemy laboratory, the daguerreotype room, the silver workshop, shouting like a man possessed in some high-sounding and fluent but completely incomprehensible language. He was about to finish off the rest of the house when Aureliano asked the neighbors for help. 10 men were needed to get him down, 14 to tie him up, 20 to drag him to the chestnut tree in the courtyard, where they left him, tied up, barking in the strange language and giving off a green froth at the mouth. When Ursula and Amarantha returned, he was still tied to the trunk of the chestnut tree by his hands and feet, soaked with rain and in a state of total innocence. They spoke to him, and he looked at them without recognizing them, saying things they did not understand. Ursula untied his wrists and ankles, lacerated by the pressure of the rope, and left him tied only by the waist. Later on, they built him a shelter of palm branches to protect him from the sun and the rain. Aureliano Buendía and Remedios Mascote were married one Sunday in March before the altar Father Nicanor Reyna had set up in the parlor. It was the culmination of 4 weeks of shocks in the Mascote household, because little Remedios had reached puberty before getting over the habits of childhood. In spite of the fact that her mother had taught her about the changes of adolescence, one February afternoon she burst shouting into the living room, where her sisters were chatting with Aureliano, and showed them her panties, smeared with a chocolate-coloured paste. A month for the wedding was agreed upon. There was barely enough time to teach her how to wash herself, get dressed by herself, and understand the fundamental business of a home. They made her urinate over hot bricks in order to cure her of the habit of wetting her bed. It took a good deal of work to convince her of the inviolability of the marital secret, for Remedios was so confused, and at the same time so amazed at the revelation, that she wanted to talk to everybody about the details of the wedding night. It was a fatiguing effort, but on the date set for the ceremony, the child was as adept in the ways of the world as any of her sisters. Don Apolinar Moscote escorted her by the arm down the street that was decorated with flowers and wreaths amidst the explosion of rockets and the music of several bands, and she waved with her hand and gave her thanks with a smile to those who wished her good luck from the windows. Aureliano, dressed in black, wearing the same patent leather boots with metal fasteners that he would have on a few years later as he faced the firing squad, had an intense paleness and a hard lump in his throat when he met the bride at the door of the house and led her to the altar. She behaved so naturally, with such discretion, that she did not lose her composure, not even when Aureliano dropped the ring as he tried to put it on her finger. In the midst of the murmurs and confusion of the guests, she kept her arm, with the fingerless lace glove, held up, and remained like that with her ring finger ready until the bridegroom managed to stop the ring with his foot before it rolled to the door and came back blushing to the altar. Her mother and sisters suffered so much from the fear that the child would do something wrong during the ceremony that in the end they were the ones who committed the impertinence of picking her up to kiss her. From that day on, the sense of responsibility, the natural grace, the calm control that Remedios would have in the face of adverse circumstances was revealed. It was she who, on her own initiative, put aside the largest piece that she had cut from the wedding cake and took it on a plate with a fork to José Arcadio Buendía. Tied to the trunk of the chestnut tree, huddled on a wooden stool underneath the palm shelter, the enormous old man, discolored by the sun and rain, made a vague smile of gratitude and ate the piece of cake with his fingers, mumbling an unintelligible psalm. The only unhappy person in that noisy celebration, which lasted until dawn on Monday, was Rebecca Buendía. It was her own frustrated party. By an arrangement of Ursula's, her marriage was to be celebrated on the same day. But that Friday, Pietro Crespi received a letter with the news of his mother's imminent death. The wedding was postponed. Pietro Crespi left for the capital of the province an hour after receiving the letter, and on the road he missed his mother, who arrived punctually Saturday night, and at Aureliano's wedding sang the sad aria that she had prepared for the wedding of her son. Pietro Crespi returned on Sunday midnight to sweep up the ashes of the party, after having worn out 5 horses on the road in an attempt to be in time for his wedding. It was never discovered who wrote the letter. Tormented by Ursula, Amarantha wept with indignation and swore her innocence in front of the altar, which the carpenters had not finished dismantling. Father Nicanor Reyna, whom Don Apolinar Mascote had brought from the swamp to officiate at the wedding, was an old man hardened by the ingratitude of his ministry. His skin was sad, with the bones almost exposed, and he had a pronounced round stomach and the expression of an old angel, which came more from simplicity than from goodness. He had planned to return to his parish after the wedding, but he was appalled at the hardness of the inhabitants of Macondo, who were prospering in the midst of scandal, subject to the natural law, without baptizing their children or sanctifying their festivals. Thinking that no land needed the seed of God so much, he decided to stay on for another week to Christianize both circumcised and Gentile, legalized concubinage, and give the sacraments to the dying. But no one paid any attention to him. They would answer him that they had been many years without a priest, arranging the business of their souls directly with God, and that they had lost the evil of original sin. Tired of preaching in the open, Father Nicanor decided to undertake the building of a church, the largest in the world, with life-size saints and stained-glass windows on the sides, so that people would come from Rome to honor God in the center of impiety. He went everywhere begging alms with a copper dish. They gave him a large amount, but he wanted more, because the church had to have a bell that would raise the drowned up to the surface of the water. He pleaded so much that he lost his voice. His bones began to fill with sounds. One Saturday, not even having collected the price of the doors, he fell into a desperate confusion. He improvised an altar in the square, and on Sunday he went through the town with a small bell, as in the days of insomnia, calling people to an open-air mass. Many went out of curiosity, others from nostalgia, others so that God would not take the disdain for his intermediary as a personal insult, so that at 8 in the morning half the town was in the square, where Father Nicanor chanted the Gospels in a voice that had been lacerated by his pleading. At the end, when the congregation began to break up, he raised his arm, signaling for attention. "Just a moment," he said. "Now we shall witness an undeniable proof of the infinite power of God." The boy who had helped him with the mass brought him a cup of thick and steaming chocolate, which he drank without pausing to breathe. Then he wiped his lips with a handkerchief that he drew from his sleeve, extended his arms, and closed his eyes. Thereupon Father Nicanor rose 6 inches above the level of the ground. It was a convincing measure. He went among the houses for several days, repeating the demonstration of levitation by means of chocolate, while the acolyte collected so much money in a bag that in less than a month he began the construction of the church. No one doubted the divine origin of the demonstration, except José Arcadio Buendía, who, without changing expression, watched a troop of people who gathered around the chestnut tree one morning to witness the revelation once more. He merely stretched on his stool a little and shrugged his shoulders when Father Nicanor began to rise up from the ground along with the chair he was sitting on.
"Hoc est simplicissimus,"
José Arcadio Buendía said.
"Homo este statum quartum materiae invenient."
Father Nicanor raised his hands, and the 4 legs of the chair all landed on the ground at the same time.
"Nego," he said, "factum hoc existentiam Dei probat sine dubio."
Thus it was discovered that José Arcadio Buendía's devilish jargon was Latin. Father Nicanor took advantage of the circumstance of his being the only person who had been able to communicate with him to try to inject the faith into his twisted mind. Every afternoon he would sit by the chestnut tree preaching in Latin, but José Arcadio Buendía insisted on rejecting rhetorical tricks and the transmutation of chocolate, and he demanded the daguerreotype of God as the only proof. Father Nicanor then brought him medals and pictures, and even a reproduction of the Veronica, but José Arcadio Buendía rejected them as artistic objects without any scientific basis. He was so stubborn that Father Nicanor gave up his attempts at evangelization and continued visiting him out of humanitarian feelings. But then it was José Arcadio Buendía who took the lead and tried to break down the priest's faith with rationalist tricks. On a certain occasion, when Father Nicanor brought a checker set to the chestnut tree and invited him to a game, José Arcadio Buendía would not accept, because according to him he could never understand the sense of a contest in which the two adversaries have agreed upon the rules. Father Nicanor, who had never seen checkers played that way, could not play it again. Ever more startled at José Arcadio Buendía's lucidity, He asked him how it was possible that they had tied him to a tree.
"Hoc est simplicissimus," he replied, "because I'm crazy."
From then on, concerned about his own faith, the priest did not come back to visit him, and dedicated himself to hurrying along the building of the church. Rebecca felt her hopes being reborn. Her future was predicated on the completion of the work. For one Sunday, when Father Nicanor was lunching at the house, and the whole family sitting at the table spoke of the solemnity and splendor that religious ceremonies would acquire when the church was built, Amaranta said, "The luckiest one will be Rebecca." And since Rebecca did not understand what she meant, she explained it to her with an innocent smile.
"You're going to be the one who will inaugurate the church with your wedding."
Rebecca tried to forestall any comments. The way the construction was going, the church would not be built before another 10 years. Father Nicanor did not agree. The growing generosity of the faithful permitted him to make more optimistic calculations. To the mute indignation of Rebecca, who could not finish her lunch, Ursula celebrated Amaranta's idea and contributed a considerable sum for the work to move faster. Father Nicanor felt that with another contribution like that, the church would be ready within 3 years. From then on, Rebecca did not say another word to Amaranta, convinced that her initiative had not the innocence that she attempted to give it. "That was the least serious thing I could have done," Amaranta answered her during the violent argument they had that night. "In that way, I won't have to kill you for 3 years." Rebecca accepted the challenge. When Pietro Crespi found out about the new postponement, he went through a crisis of disappointment. But Rebecca gave him a final proof of her loyalty.
"We'll elope whenever you say," she told him.
Pietro Crespi, however, was not a man of adventure. He lacked the impulsive character of his fiancée, and he considered respect for one's given word as a wealth that should not be squandered. Then Rebecca turned to more audacious methods. A mysterious wind blew out the lamps in the parlour, and Ursula surprised the lovers kissing in the dark. Pietro Crespi gave her some confused explanations about the poor quality of modern pitch lamps, and he even helped her install a more secure system of illumination for the room. But the fuel failed again, or the wicks became clogged, and Ursula found Rebecca sitting on her fiancé's lap. This time she would accept no explanation. She turned the responsibility of the bakery over to the Indian woman and sat in a rocking chair to watch over the young couple during the visits, ready to win out over manoeuvres that had already been old when she was a girl.
"Poor Mama,"
Rebecca would say with mock indignation, seeing Ursula yawn during the boredom of the visits.
"When she dies, she'll go off to her reward in that rocking chair."
After 3 months of supervised love, fatigued by the slow progress of the construction, which he went to inspect every day, Pietro Crespi decided to give Father Nicanor the money he needed to finish the church. Amaranta did not grow impatient. As she conversed with her girlfriends every afternoon when they came to embroider on the porch, she tried to think of new subterfuges. A mistake in calculation spoiled the one she considered the most effective, removing the mothballs that Rebecca had put in her wedding dress before she put it away in the bedroom dresser. She did it when 2 months were left for the completion of the church. But Rebecca was so impatient with the approach of the wedding that she wanted to get the dress ready earlier than Amaranta had foreseen. When she opened the dresser and unfolded first the papers and then the protective cloth, she found the fabric of the dress and the stitches of the veil and even the crown of orange blossoms perforated by moths. Although she was sure that she had put a handful of mothballs in the wrappings, the disaster seemed so natural that she did not dare blame Amaranta. There was less than a month until the wedding, but Amparo Moscote promised to sew a new dress within a week. Amaranta felt faint that rainy noontime when Amparo came to the house, wrapped in the froth of needlework for Rebecca to have the final fitting of the dress. She lost her voice, and a thread of cold sweat ran down the path of her spine. For long months she had trembled with fright, waiting for that hour, because if she had not been able to conceive the ultimate obstacle to Rebecca's wedding, she was sure that at the last moment, when all the resources of her imagination had failed, she would have the courage to poison her. That afternoon, while Rebecca was suffocating with heat inside the armor of thread that Amparo Moscote was putting about her body with thousands of pins and infinite patience, Amaranta made several mistakes in her crocheting and pricked her finger with the needle, but she decided, with frightful coldness, that the date would be the last Friday before the wedding, and the method would be a dose of laudanum in her coffee. A greater obstacle, as impassable as it was unforeseen, obliged a new and indefinite